You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 7th to the 13th of August. My name is John Elms, and today I'm joined by editor John Gill, deputy news editor John Morgan, and reporter David Matthews. Executive pay is back under the microscope after a THE survey found that vice chancellors' salary increases bear no relation to performance at their universities in terms of student applications. David Matthew will have the lowdown on that. Patience Shell, the author of our cover feature, believes that academic work needn't, nay, shouldn't, be all-consuming, and scholars should learn when to relax and leave the office behind. John Gill, who has just spent a conference with the creme de la creme of global academic leaders, will have something to say about that in due course. And finally, when former Higher Education Minister David Willetts announced the proposal for universities to buy their graduates' debt recently, he was thrust back into the spotlight. But is his plan sound or silly? John Morgan has been poring over the detail and will take us through that. But first, David, your piece is bound to raise the hackles of our readers. What have you discovered?
Well, so I did a sort of statistical analysis where I looked at how much vice-chancellor's pay had changed between 2011-12 and 2012-13. We've already done this analysis, but I matched it up with UCAS figures that showed student applications in 2012-13. So this is the first year when people are paying up to £9,000 fees. Just as I genuinely didn't know what I was going to find, I thought it would be an interesting thing to look at to see whether there's any relation. You know, in this new supposed market, are vice chancellors being rewarded if they get big applications in their first year? And I guess I was slightly surprised to find that there's basically no correlation at all statistically between these two things. So the interesting thing about this is it does shed some light on what and what not vice chancellors are actually being rewarded for, and it raises all kinds of questions, really. I mean, about what they should be incentivized to do. I mean, you could say that this is a very short-term measure if you're just based on how many applications you get through the door. There are things you could do, such as lowering admissions criteria, that would bump up your applications, but wouldn't actually improve the reputation of your university. Having said that, I expect a lot of readers will wonder, well, you know, there was one vice chancellor at Simon Ofield Kerr, who's at the University of Creative Arts, and almost a 30% drop in applications. And then the following year, he gets a 5% rise in remuneration. Well, begs the question, if you can preside over that, then, you know, what will actually cause a drop in your salary, or at least a below-inflation rise?
I suppose the obvious comeback that I would anticipate we may get from this piece is that, you know, in terms of key performance indicators, to use the lingo, is, you know, what are they being measured on? There's a whole raft of things. There'll be performance, or any number of things that you could measure a vice chancellor on, and they may well be looking at. But I suppose we're using this as a admittedly very rough proxy for the popularity of that university in a given year. This is supposedly the age of the student consumer.
Absolutely,
these are your client base, if you like, and you know, how is the popularity of your institution rising or falling within that client base? So I think it's a fair, if rough and ready, proxy, and interesting to see that, as David said, there's really no correlation at all there.
Yeah, I mean, when I did it, I didn't know quite what to expect. I thought there'd be some correlation at least, because that is, you know, as you say, it is a measure of popularity. Students might not always, you know, that might not necessarily be a fair measure of popularity, but if you suffer a really serious drop in applications, that has a big financial knock-on effect on your university, average grades might go down. It can cause all kinds of problems.
I suppose one of the things that this points out, which we do already know, of course, is that there's very little transparency on what vice chancellor's pay is being set against and measured against. I mean, it's always said that one of the sort of inflationary factors in vice chancellor's pay over the last decade or more has been the fact that we, as a magazine, publish an annual survey setting out what they are, and universities being the sort of competitive institutions they are, where they're all trying to go up the league tables and attract the best people, look at each other and say, well, we're saying in all our sort of manifestos and so on that we're a world-class university, we have to be paying a salary for a world-class vice-chancellor. And there's that aspect to it. But I think one thing, the UCU have tried to actually use FOI to get details on the criteria that are used at different institutions to set pay, and have been largely obstructed in getting access to that information, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. So they issued an FOI to all universities, and 4/5 basically refused to release minutes. And even those that did, most of them were kind of redacted. So we basically don't know what vice-chancellor enumerated on. And you can argue, well, what they're being remunerated on sets the priorities for the university. So we basically don't really know what the leader of the university, what targets they're being given for the university. It will be useful to know. And hopefully this piece does shed some light that on something it definitely they're not being incentivized.
One final point, John. In your introduction, you talked about VC pay being under the microscope. I'm not sure it's a microscope that you need when you're studying VC pay.
Okay, perhaps the, Hubble telescope? Is that the the antithesis?
I need to stand a very long way back.
Yes. Okay, thanks for shattering my metaphor there, John. As we've just been talking about, that story is on page 6 and 7 of our magazine. Now, John, Frankie Goes to Hollywood famously said, relax. And that's sort of tenuously linked to the subject of our cover feature.
Your intros are really shining today, John.
I think that's a great one, actually. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece. I mean, what we, all work and no play makes Johnny a dull boy, or whatever the saying goes.
Jack a dull boy.
This piece is looking at the issue of the need to do more than just work, and it's a really interesting article from an academic who's looked in some depth at this issue, and she's making the argument very eloquently and in a timely fashion in summer, that work shouldn't be all-consuming. Actually, if you look at the productivity of workers in different industries, but including in academia, a sort of unremitting focus on work without any time to sort of go away and think and be creative is a really negative thing. She looks back through sort of historical figures, so talks about Benjamin Franklin and George O'Keefe and Charles Darwin, and the way that they sort of ensured that they injected a bit of leisure time into their working day. Patient Shell herself is somebody who uses kind of walking, hiking as a sort of way to improve her creativity and productivity. And it's a really interesting piece. I think a lot of people in the profession where, long hours are a bit of a culture and probably a bit of a problem at some institutions. Often, to be fair, self-imposed. I think people, she starts her piece by saying that some years ago a colleague characterised her as, quote, someone who didn't work weekends. She points out that this description wasn't meant as a compliment. And there is a bit of a feeling, I think, sometimes, you can say the same in lots of industries, I'm sure, that there's an overwhelming pressure for people to be working 24 hours in the day, and actually that isn't necessarily a positive either for the individual or perhaps for their employer and their productivity as well. I mean, you mentioned earlier that I've just been on a conference. Last week I was in Brazil at the university conference with 1,100 vice-chancellors in one room, if you can imagine such a thing. And they're obviously in a very specific type of role, vice-chancellors, but clearly very hard-working people. But even there, I saw a few of them taking time to sit down, knock back a caipirinha or two. So I think there's a space for a bit of relaxation for everybody.
But isn't there sort of, I guess, a comeback to the point this piece is making that, well, lots of academics would love to be able to go and walk around in the garden like Darwin, but it's not self-imposed, it's imposed by the university and all the admin and bureaucracy they've got to do.
I suppose so. I mean, but to what extent is it not self-imposed? I mean, academics are always going to be very hard-working people. And I think she makes the point that because it's a vocational job, you're perhaps more susceptible in academia to, putting in longer hours than you perhaps should because you love doing it and that's why you went into it. And that will always be the case. Certainly, I'm sure there would be some comeback saying, well, the bureaucracy, the paperwork, the form filling, all that stuff is on top of all the stuff that academics do because they love doing, and yes, it takes an awful lot of time, but I think she's just making a very sensible case, actually, and I would certainly make the case in our industry as journalists. You do need time to go away and think about things and be creative, otherwise kind of nose to the grindstone element can stymie some of the more interesting aspects of what you do and what you produce.
True. It doesn't necessarily have to be empirical, it's just an idea, a manifesto for introducing some downtime in your in one's working life. I think that's across the board. Well, that piece, should you go and choose to read it, I very much recommend it, is on page 32 of our magazine. Away from relaxation and academic downtime, John, no sooner has David Willetts left his position, but he's back making headlines again. Glutton for punishment?
Yeah, so he's been on Newsnight and writing in the Financial Times about his plan to have universities buy the debt of their graduates. So graduates would be repaying their loans direct to their universities. And his theory is that this would give universities an incentive to improve employability for their graduates because they would have a financial stake in their graduates finding good jobs and repaying a high proportion of their loans. And this is being seen by many people as a route to higher fees for some universities. And indeed, from people I spoke to, the argument was, why on earth would any university support this idea of taking a huge amount of debt on unless the quid pro quo was them being allowed to charge higher fees in return for those universities that have kind of the graduates who are most successful in the job market. They would argue that they should be allowed to charge higher fees in return. And there are kind of a lot of concerns about this plan, and kind of among them would be the fact that it seems that under the version of the idea that's been considered by the government, the sums of money are so large that actually the universities would still have to borrow the money from the government to buy the graduate debt and create some kind of special purpose vehicle that was owning the debt that might actually end up being bigger than the university. And then when the money came back in, the university would have to pay off the portion that it still owed to the government before taking the money back for itself. So it sounds like it's going to be an extremely complex operation.
So it's not going to simplify matters.
Yeah, perpetual cycle of debt, that sounds
and
like.
And if universities are only going to support it if they get a route to higher fees, well, then you've also got the question of getting a majority of MPs to vote for higher fees. Mm. So there's an enormous number of hurdles. To this idea.
Who in the sector is backing the idea? I mean, we always, when these kind of announcements come up, it's very quick, the opposition voice, but who?
Well, David Willetts, or the reports on his idea at least, seem to be saying that there were six so-called leading universities in favour of the idea. Mm. Say the quote I got from the Russell Group was lukewarm at best. They said there might be some advantages in selling the loan book in separate tranches, but Wendy Pyatt said that without knowing the detail of what's proposed, it's not possible to say whether a particular scheme would be attractive to Russell Group universities. But behind the scenes, it sounds like there are a handful of Russell Group universities that are very interested in this idea, but only, as I say,
And one of the kind of instant spin-offs from this story was the suggestion that the outcome would be fees of up to £16,000 at Cambridge and Oxford.
Oxford have said that the real cost of educating one of their students is £16,000, although Nick Hillman, director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, always says that he's asked Oxford many, many times for evidence of their workings and some argument to back up their case that it does cost this amount of money, and they've never produced anything, and that figure does seem to be based on some, perhaps sketchy calculations, but certainly calculations that haven't been made public.
Mm. In his timing of saying it, as in post him stepping down, is he just saying that this is what he wants his legacy to be?
I think he's pitching it as an idea that could be included in the Conservative manifesto for the next election as a way of saying, yeah, we're incentivising universities to improve graduate employability, but the timing is also down to the fact that the government wanted to sell the loan book to banks or pension funds, but it's now evident that they would have to pay too high a subsidy to the banks to make it attractive, so it wouldn't be value for money for the taxpayer. This is another way of taking forward the loan book sale while giving, in theory, giving those universities incentives on employability. So a way of kind of helping the government get the loan book off its books and making the public finances look better.
Mm, absolutely. An immensely complex subject, but John has unpicked it and put it down on pages 22 and 23 of the magazine. This issue is chock full of fantastic stories, but there was one particular story that caught your eye, John, just in summation.
I think this came out of the student exam howlers.
It did. It was Times Higher Education generated.
Somehow didn't win. But very interesting, actually. Quite aside from the headline, a crafty cheek and sinister butter. I'll pick that up. There is actually reason in this madness. But an academic's got in touch about a new phenomenon that he's noticed of quite extraordinary language in some of his students' essays, and one in particular where such phrases appeared as bequest mazes, Herculean liturgies, and sinister butter. And he's left scratching his head wondering what on earth this was all about, until he realised that this was a new phenomenon. He's coined a phrase, rogeing, as in Roger's thesaurus, because he discovered that what these phrases were, this was a student who was essentially plagiarising some other work, but was looking up in the thesaurus synonyms for the word to try and change so it wouldn't be picked up, presumably, by plagiarism detection software. But of course, unwittingly, was completely changing the whole piece. So, sinister buttocks, someone help me. What were they trying to say?
Left behind.
Left behind.
It's a quite literal swapping.
Enough said on that, I think.
It is a remarkably funny and quite important, actually, article, because I think we've all been guilty of trying to find synonyms for words in the past.
We've all been guilty of plagiarism. No, we haven't.
I didn't say that.
You're fired.
I meant in my exams. I mean, in my essays. Okay, I've gone too far on that one. I'm afraid that's it for this week's issue review. But if you want to make a comment on any of the content in the magazine, you can do so on our website at www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. We're available on all social media outputs, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+. So there is numerous ways of getting in touch with us if you want to. But as I say, that's all we've got time for. So until next week, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.